Okay, school's in session again. Any comments or questions before we go on? I see where Nancy had added beauty versus self-expression in terms of our discussion of some of the great conflicts in the war of ideas today. That's a good addition. Well, we go on now to our thinking, our focus segment, and we're, of course, working in this class with David Mamet's The Secret Knowledge. Start with a few questions. Does the secret knowledge add to the effort to establish mental or emotional peace, or does it subtract from it, and why? Any input? While you're pondering on that, Rose suggested during the break that I mention a series of 36 lectures that we got from the teaching company called The History of the English Language. It's a series presented by Seth Lehrer, a professor at Stanford University, The History of the English Language, and that includes prehistory, the Indo-European origin of words. Excellent stuff. I highly recommend them for people who are interested in words as words. Okay, so this is giving you a chance to think a little bit about, does this book add to the effort to establish mental or emotional peace, or does it subtract from it, and why?
Well, if a liberal would even sit down and read it, I don't think he would probably add to his peace unless he could have a breakthrough like M.A.
Yeah, well,
so it would stress him out.
Of course, the concept of this book is, by M.A.'s own description, the concept is that he was living in an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
He was living a false life where he acted conservatively, but thought of himself as a liberal. So he had a conflict going on there within himself, and he didn't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
Until it was pointed out, and obviously the conflict then had to be resolved. So there's probably a lot of people like him that if they would read the book and think about it, they could resolve their own personal conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The first result of outgrowing his liberal heritage was, as I just suggested, conflict. A closed-minded person experiences no conflict until they start arguing with other people. The closed-minded person has made up his mind and does not want it to be confused by reality. But when the light of reality begins to seep through the cracks in the superstructure, inner conflict begins. And in this case, the conflict is a useful, important, helpful process is the pangs of self-discovery. And the person begins to ask questions and to doubt his fervent beliefs. This can be exceedingly painful but liberating. Mamet is a good enough thinker to recognize that certain assumptions he made growing up in a Jewish household were fundamentally flawed. Instead of conflict, his experience was probably more along the lines of painful recognition or revelation. Painful because he realized that he and a whole generation of Jewish American males were deprived of their manhood. Of course, the implication here is that Jewish girls are always deprived. Because it's only the males that get taken in and given the secrets and so on. So here's an interesting question I hope you all chew on and we can talk about it a little bit. Is conservative ideology any better than liberal ideology? In other words, have you gone through the same process of questioning your cultural assumptions that Mamet did? Assuming that you grew up conservative. Now, some of you, I know, grew up liberal and have gone through this process and seen the limitations of liberal ideology. I hope you have not just accepted conservative ideology, because there is a conservative ideology, and it is every bit as limiting as the liberal ideology. The goal is not to exchange one ideology for another, but to learn to think clearly about these subjects. So, again, let me pose that question. Is conservative ideology any better than liberal ideology? And have you gone through the process of questioning your cultural assumptions as Mamet does?
I mean, you certainly mentioned earlier that they are both limitations. I know that in listening to Reich and, every now and then Charles, and they are both really great thinkers, and they seem to get trapped in the ideology. Reich more so than Charles.
Yeah.
Krauthammer. Sorry.
Well, Krauthammer was liberal and switched.
That's right. That's true.
But anybody can be trapped if they accept the ideology, the talking points. It may be more difficult for a conservative in this situation to review their cultural assumptions than a liberal, because a liberal would have this book as a guideline.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hear some more discussion. Anybody got any ideas about this? Are you influenced by right-wing ideologies, or do you think independently of ideologues? Yeah.
Because I have a less critical eye when it's like, oh, well, so and so is, you know, from this institution or that institution, they're going to say some things. You know, I might listen with a little more interest. But because, I think a lot of kids, and, you know, when you're in college, I come from a small town, pretty conservative upbringing. Went to college, big, giant university, confronted with a lot of new ideas and things that I had never been exposed to before. I kind of dived into all of that stuff. And then as I got older and started to develop a little bit of this thing about that, kind of weave through things. And one of the things sometimes when things don't make sense, that, you know, should be a red flag.
Can you give me an example of that?
I guess the whole idea of the mid-century, early 20th century, mid-20th century philosophies of, like, existentialism and, you know, the whole idea that it doesn't matter what you do, because you're just going to die anyway, and it's all over after that. You know,
okay.
So who cares?
All right.
It's not just from being raised in the Catholic Church, but I think I've always instinctively sensed that, you know, not the end, and I've always had an affinity to learning about either religions or cultures where the idea or concept of reincarnation was part of the culture, part of what, or in literature or in poetry, you know, when you grasp this little glimpse of, there is an infinite, and there is eternal, and there are some things that last forever. And then also the same thing, you know, with science, when you understand the principle that energy is neither ever destroyed nor created.
Right.
States. When things don't make sense against that, then I kind of think to myself, that isn't something that I want to invest a lot of energy into studying or pursuing or thinking about. Maybe that's not like the wisest opinion out there.
Okay. Some other contributions here. Yes.
This is perhaps most crucial, but I got the real message that ideologists, they didn't want you.
That.
And it was they were not as beautiful as the prince, so that became Turkey. And during self-intellectual, like captive, and I had some money in the market. Different degree studying, and they would send you all these badges like that. I was very proud of being part of that. I would open these letters and it would say, really need your input. And then they would state the questions that the cat could for me. I remember going through, writing down my thoughts and all the things, and I thought, wait a second here. I get to the end, and then now that you've written all this, will you contribute?
Yes, that's all they wanted was money.
And it was like, they don't care what I felt for the first time. It was like, whoa. And then I thought.
Their input is measured by green pieces of paper. With pictures of presidents on it.
Right, I don't even know what to do. You know, it's just they don't want you to think any more than the liberals want, you know, their base thing. They just want you to follow. So.
Right. Okay, some other input. The reason why I'm taking time to pose this question is, to me, the great power of this book, The Secret Knowledge, is that it is a thorough exposure of an ideology. But to me, it doesn't matter what the ideology is. All ideologies need to be exposed as fraudulent and phony. Because an ideology is not thinking. By definition, no ideology or theology involves thinking. It involves dogma. This is the dogma. You memorize it. You spout it. You regurgitate it. Doesn't matter whether it's the dogma of the left or the dogma of the right. You simply spout it like a parrot. No thinking is involved. So a conservative ideology is no better than a liberal ideology if it's an ideology. And it creates the appearance of thinking, but you're just chewing up ideas that somebody else digested for you. Put in the most blunt way I can. And that's true with theology. Theology, whether it's Christian or Hindu or Muslim or whatever, it's not the teachings of the Christ, it's the teachings of Augustine or the teachings of Aquinas or the teachings of somebody other than the Christ. And so it stops being a lesson on Christianity, and it starts being a lesson of somebody's opinion of Christianity. Now, the analogy I like to use is if I'm going to explore a foreign country, I want a map that I can read and follow, but I don't want a map drawn by somebody that only wants me to see certain things. Because then I'm not exploring that foreign country, I'm exploring their version, their interpretation of it. I want to explore the mind of God and discover it, and I'm delighted to get all the help I can from reliable sources like the Alice Bailey books and the other books that we've featured from time to time back with the book club. But I don't want somebody to do my thinking for me. I don't want to be a little parrot. I want to think these issues through. And when it makes me suspicious when people come through and say, this is what conservatives believe, or this is what conservatives think. There needs to be an active discussion. And that's what this book does so well. It tears apart the assumptions that he grew up embracing and then tears apart their current applicability. So some other input on this. Anybody else?
A view of that's rather narrow and absolute, and I'm one of those people who were conservative rather later in life. And as a Catholic, especially, what came to mind was the whole concept of wealth and poverty, you know, where the poverty was positive and the wealth was totally the negative. And, you know, wealth inspires more resentment and jealousy than an asset. You know, that could help everyone.
Yeah.
A specific example of what came to mind, but not making much room for alternative thinking or, you know, opening up windows or doors, even though I think Pope John with his ecumenical council was opening the windows for fresh air.
Yeah. Well, it's curious because the Catholic Church can do that, and unfortunately, one of our paradigms for thinking in or approaching thought in the West is the Catholic Church, which doesn't involve feedback. You know, there was a point in which the Catholic Church could have gone in a different direction. There was a big fight in the War of Ideas between St. Augustine and, I don't know, Anselm or somebody. And Anselm, as I recall it, wanted to set up churches, and he did throughout England and Europe and whatnot, that were based on personal experience of the divine. You meditated. You learned to think for yourself and interpret revelation yourself. Augustine argued against that and said the church was vitally a vital link in the chain. Nobody could be saved except through the church. Now that's an insult to the life of the Christ. But
I was talking with a young teacher at my school. I actually saw her as a possible Walden Grove teacher. He had just started, and I gave her some of the booklets, and she came back to me about a week later and just said, "I could never teach in that school because only Jesus can save." You know, I was saying it would be open, you know, or maybe I was talking about the meditation in the morning, or that would be open to all faiths and, you know, an understanding of all religions. And I mean, just that closed door, here's somebody in like a 20s and already that door is closed.
Okay.
And yet when we talked about people within the academics, she said, "Oh, I want to hear more about this. This just sounds ideal." The minute I brought in the faith element,
Well, this is one of the things I find about conservative ideology. A very strong component of it is, of course, the fundamentalist church. And, you know, God bless them all, but they're importing into their interpretation of conservative ideology a lot of fundamentalist Christian attitudes and of doubt and skepticism. And I'm profoundly aware that there are many people that label themselves conservative that would never vote for Mitt Romney because he's a Mormon. Not because they disagree with him, but because he's a Mormon. And Mormons aren't fundamentalist Christians. They're Christians, maybe. They won't probably even admit that. But he's a Mormon. Oh, sin of all sins. The fact that Mormons are very conservative people in their lifestyle and very family-oriented, that they have all the attributes that conservatives are supposed to have, but they're not fundamentalist Christians. Therefore, you can never vote for them. Okay. Well, I find that, frankly, I find it terribly limiting. And they need a mental massage, or worse, or more. Mm-hmm. Any other input here?
Carl, I've been looking up, trying to find the root of conservatism or conservative, and I'm struggling to find something, and could it relate to sir? I liked how you earlier talked about liberal or as the root meaning to liberate. So kind of going back to the roots of these words is something I thought could be useful and interesting.
Sure. I would think that the root of conservative is conserving principles. Making sure that you guard and protect and you stand vigil over truth as you have discerned it. And so the conservative is one who conserves the first principles of the Constitution. They try to conserve the essence of what it means to be a constitutionalist. Now, the problem here is that many of people who call themselves conservatives are very literal and very fundamentalist, and so they don't have the ability to recognize that they're the essence of the founding is what counts, not necessarily a literal interpretation, because after all, the words themselves have changed meaning. And so if you're going to be a literal constitutionalist, you have to go back and understand the meaning of words in 1789, not 2011. This is one of the influences where theology gets in the way of good conservative thinking and stifles the discussion. So, for example, some conservatives have one litmus test, and that is, a candidate has to be pro-life. And there's no demonstrable tolerance for pro-choice. And in fact, some of them wanted an amendment to the Constitution banning abortion. Well, that's taking the entire scope of American life and boiling it down to one key issue that may be right, may be wrong, but they're overemphasizing it. They're throwing the whole political structure out of balance. They're making it a slave to rational or to irrational thinking. And so that's a limitation. That's a sign of conservative ideology rather than conservative thinking. Somebody got a kazoo? No, anyway.
Is that a fire truck or something?
Our boards are open.
Ah, okay. Well, good, good. So, in any event, I just wanted to say that the real meaning of the meaning of this book and why I assigned it was not to simply gloat over the exposure of liberalism, but to get us thinking about any ideology and the need to recognize that there are no shortcuts to thinking, there are only thinking skills, and we have to develop these thinking skills. Okay, let's see, to comment about a few of the things Mamé says. There's the statement on page 42 at the top. The philosophy of the left is not, in fact, a love of wisdom, but a rejection of wisdom. And it's contrary to common sense. He's talking about wealth. Where is wealth to come from? So this is one of the key issues here. He goes on, if we are no longer to explore, to drill, to develop, or to use the world around us, and those things fashioned from that world, if we are to cap and trade, that which is essentially an imaginary commodity, carbon emissions, if we are to tax and limit growth in service of a fantasy, who is to chance his time and treasure to produce the wealth and how? So, one of the fundamental assumptions of conservative thought is the free market system, capitalism. And one of the assumptions of leftist liberalism is socialism. The socialist, the liberal, wants a state and wants to pretend, erroneously, that the state creates and owns all wealth. Whereas the conservative knows that all authority for government comes from we the people, and that no matter how awkward it might be or cumbersome, we should never have a strong central government that denies the opportunity for individuals to go out and create wealth and create prosperity. And he does a very nice job of exposing this. But it's a very significant point, because the conservative, by nature, puts no limits on how much the economy can grow. And so under a conservative approach of fiscal responsibility, you can increase the marketplace, the GDP, or the gross national product. You can increase that to the point where you can pay off your debts by increased prosperity. Obama keeps saying he can't do that because he believes in zero-sum thinking or stinking. So this is a fundamental difference here. Now, within that context, however, you see there's the ideology creeps in, where even though conservatives believe in the free market, some conservatives, for whatever reason, are willing to put limitations on that free market through excise taxes, various taxations that keeping, one of the ideas here is buy American first. Well, I don't know. I kind of like driving my Honda, and the Honda is made right there in Marysville. I was going to say River City. One of the problems of conservative ideology is it tends to be semi-chauvinistic. And so we have to buy American, not realizing that you can buy a Honda that's been made in America. And that, in fact, international trade is a damn good thing because many, many, many American jobs are created by international trade. So this is where ideology can stamp on things and stifle your mind rather than open it up. But the basic conflict is between capitalism and socialism. Now, he goes on, the religion of the left is to leave until that world whose operations it does not understand and failing to investigate fears. It therefore mythologizes uselessness and praises it. This is one of the most damning statements he makes in the whole book. The left mythologizes uselessness. Well, you know, when you stop and think about it, it makes good sense. Not to do that, but the left does it. Because the left, as much as it tries to ignore this, the left has pretty much assumed control of Europe, socialist Europe. And again, as I mentioned before, it's the aristocracy that runs the state, the elite, the people that know how to do this. And they don't let the average person into the inner circle. It is the preservation of the aristocracy. And so, of course, liberalism that overthrew the monarchy is reinstating it by calling it something different. But what is more useless in any society than the aristocracy? They don't work. They inherit their wealth in the form of property from their great-great-great-grandparents that did the king a favor and got awarded 1,500 acres somewhere, or 15,000 acres. And so, of course, the left prizes uselessness, which doesn't occur in this country. The point I'm making is that the nature of America is antithetical to socialism. We've adopted some aspects of it, but they haven't worked. We know they haven't worked. We want to try to reform them or get rid of them. But we have to understand that America was based on free market assumptions, not socialist assumptions. And socialism doesn't work, in education. So he goes on, we have all seen this phenomenon as school children in the insecure and self-hating child raised to think himself weak, who will shrink from effort and from communal activity, attach himself to authorities, the tattletale, the spoilsport, who cannot take the rigors and tests of the schoolyard, the complainer and sanctimonious prig, forever calling out about supposed slights and injustices. His is the all-purpose complaint of the pre-adolescent, it's not fair. And he goes on, for mine is a generation which never grew up, and we have, in our short lives, dismantled that necessarily imperfect system of industry and government from which our parents lived and died. For which our parents lived and died. We have awarded ourselves for realizing its imperfections, as if any human act or combination were perfect, and have created a culture of guilt and shame, corrosively and compulsively shaming where any human act of individuality may be indicted as wrong, which is to say destructive of equality or equanimity. This is a brilliant analysis of sloppy thinking. We believe in equality, therefore we must have a level playing field. That doesn't follow. A level playing field eliminates equality. Affirmative action eliminates it. It means that somebody with mediocre talent gets exactly the same treatment as somebody with a great deal of talent, then it's surprise, when they can't deliver. I think I mentioned in the class on Sunday that down here in Georgia, we have lately it's come out that we had this wonderful program to get kids into college, pay for their tuition, etc. We've leveled the playing field, but half of them can't graduate. They never make it through to graduation. They drop out.
Get through the first year.
Right. Now, what does that say about our thinking? If we put people into a college with the false hope that they can compete with others and get a degree, and then they find out they can't, what does that do for their understanding of who they are and what they're supposed to be doing? They may eventually discover that they should be drive a truck, but they will always have this idea, I've got 2 years of college, what am I doing driving a truck? Making a living. But you see, that's a different kind of thing. So we have adopted this sloppy thinking. And the unintended consequences would be a whole generation of young adults that feel like they've gotten the wrong end of the stick. All right. Over here, he goes on and talks about the fact that the Jews growing up in this country have adopted the ideal of social justice rather than the justice of their own tradition. And he says, to correct this observed inequality, which the left sees as unnatural, it invented the term social justice. But a system of justice, this is important, as you probably read, because Judaism is based on justice. Moses was the lawgiver. This is the great contribution of Judaism. It brought the quality of justice into a society that didn't understand it. And so he says, but a system of justice already exists, formulated by the legislature. This is the judicial system. So why do you need social justice? It can only mean, as Hayek wrote, state justice. Here, though, the left will not follow the reasoning out to its end. The state confiscates wealth accumulated under existing laws and redistributes it to those it deems worthy. Now think about this for a moment. What is the implication? We have a president who keeps on harping on the rich need to pay their fair share. They're already paying taxes. In fact, they're paying almost all of our taxes. 50% of working people in this country don't pay any taxes at all. So the rich are already paying more than their share. They're carrying the burden of society. And yet he demonizes them and implies that this is out of balance. It is out of balance, but it's out of balance in favor of the poor and not in favor of the rich. And yet he keeps on harping on this. That's all he knows how to talk about. And so I think it was Krauthammer that said, he never answers the question, when is enough enough? If you take 10% more of the wealth of the rich, is that going to be enough? Of course not. If you take 20%, is that going to be enough? If you take 100%, is that going to be enough? No. Obama will still be saying the rich should pay more. This is bad thinking. This is fundamentally flawed, illogical, and reprehensible. There's nothing fair about it at all. But because he's not challenged in the mainstream media, generally he gets away with it until somebody like Mamet calls him on. The from the left's point of view, one need not work and may not only hope to be provided for by this government, but may insist upon it. This new post-governmental America then may without guilt, apologize for the arrogance of its prosperity and the beauty of its traditions and culture, and plead with the weak in the world to be allowed to join them. I love the chapter on the Red Sea. I'm not going to try to recreate it, but I assume you've read that. This is where, this was, an interpretation. Yes, that his son Noah came up with. I guess that's Noah as an ark. But he talks about the challenge of parting the Red Sea and crossing over and letting the sea come back and destroy the Egyptians was, in fact, the acceptance of freedom. Now, I think you have, Moses was leading his people out of slavery, 400 years of slavery, and then they got to the barrier of the sea, he parted the sea, and he interprets this as being, the sea is freedom. And they made the choice to walk through the sea away from Egypt. Behind them were the Egyptians, and they accepted freedom. Now, to me, this is one of the best chapters in the whole book, even though it's only 2.5 pages long, because I've long held, and you may recognize from earlier classes, that the Exodus from Egypt into, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness before they found their way to Palestine was the period of time, it was the extrication from attachment and entering into the world of spirit. This is the work of detachment. The issue of freedom is all about detaching yourself from your assumptions, your ideologies, your cultural training, all these things that, we joke about growing up Catholic or growing up Jewish here in his case or whatever. But these are real issues that we have to detach from and see that there is a higher reality. And that our government should be based on that higher reality, not on the absurdities of human tradition. So the Red Sea here is a symbol of crossing from slavery into freedom, detaching from physical world, emotion, and mind, and entering into the world of the soul. And yet once you achieve that freedom, it has to be maintained. We were blessed in this country with the gift of freedom by our founding fathers. It has to be maintained. It will be maintained until we get too clever by half for our own good, and then we'll throw it away. Somebody will panic and throw the alarm switch, and next thing you know, we'll be voting in a dictator to a strong man or a strong woman to tell us how to live our lives. That's the end of freedom. And this is the heart. The conservative believes in maintaining freedom. The liberal today, quite the opposite of what his title means, the liberal of today believes that there is no value in human freedom. The only value lies in the state. Okay, any final comments or questions about that? I'll end with quoting the poem by Kipling, "The men of my own stock, they may do ill or well, but they tell the lies I am wanted to. They are used to the lies I tell. And we do not need interpreters when we go to buy and sell." Hmm. That's the comfort element. I know these people. I'm as corrupt as they are. I'm comfortable with their corruption. And therefore, I continue to be enslaved by it. So, in a certain way, a certain sense, symbolically, the left is the party of slavery, the right is the party of freedom. Any final thoughts? I hope I haven't put you all to sleep here. Okay, that's it for that. Now we do our recitation, so pick up your copy of The Fabled Gate. Let me get some things up here. New artwork. Okay, here we go. We'll get around to this one. This is Oedipus and the Sphinx. We're not starting with that one, but we're starting with the Phoenix. Okay, let's see, what page is it?
Oh, 120.
Page 120. And let's see, somewhere, I don't have the listing here of our order. So let me get that up. Slight delay here while I get things. No, that's not going to do it either. Okay, so our order is, our reading order is Mary, Mimi, Nancy, Rose. Well, Nancy, are you able to participate?
No.
No, okay. All right, so it'll be Mary, Mimi, Rose, Bill, Donna, Judy, Dorothy, Betty, Ann. And I guess that's it. All right. So, we start with the Phoenix on page 120. Mary, when you're ready.
The form is temporal. It must dissolve into its dust and thus evolve, becoming truer to design and helping the earth become divine.
Some say this bird does not exist. It's just a fable, they insist. But myths are real when read aright. They lead from darkness into light.
The story of the Phoenix shows the lack of what the founder knows. It founds truth for what he sees being superficiality.
The Phoenix is an Eastern bird who views the doubter as absurd. When he grows old, his wings turn gold. His unique saga can unfold.
For once he's lived 500 years. He's weakened limbs, deafened his ears. He cannot soar as he once did and suffers damage to his ears.
As Father Time adjusts the rest, the aging phoenix builds a nest. He gathers myrrh and cinnamon to shape a mirror beneath the sun.
Atop the mighty oak and palm, the phoenix bird, this world is long.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Wasn't Betty in there?
Well, I was getting ready, but...
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you read. I'm sorry.
No.
I thought Betty read already, and I was next.
Oh, no, that was Dorothy.
So Betty.
Well, go ahead, Betty, and then Anne will be after you.
Atop a mighty oak palm, Phoenix bids the world salaam. In sweetest voice, he starts to sing an ancient dirge of recycling.
I run my course, I hear the soul, I've run my depth, I've reached my goal. Now it's time to start again, so to my life, I'll say amen.
He loves his feathers, fans of fire, which over time consumes his fire. The phoenix dies. He is no more, extinct, consigned to mythic lore.
And thus the phoenix reappears to live again 500 years, without the burdens of the old to keep him in their clutching hold.
Bill?
He rises to the radiant sun, the god who steps on a day of dawn and leaves behind the best view of what has been and what's not been.
Good. All right. Let's go on to Oedipus, hence this piece of artwork by Gustav Moreau.
Where?
Oedipus is on page 137, and we start with Judy.
The wisdom of the gods is just and great, but can destroy as surely as create. A spear that's hoisted by an unfit arm can bring the one who hurls it mortal harm.
Behold the woe of those who challenge fate and learn the price of knowledge but too late. Such is the tale of one great Theban king who thought he could defy what fate might bring.
Plans the king to celebrate an heir, the birth of Oedipus, and to prepare to raise him wisely, as Delphic seer, to speak an oracle that all might hear.
His father,
when omens are in favor, we believe. Unopposed, we argue they deceive. So Laius bids a servant trust his child and leave him for the wolves out in the wild.
A shepherd finds the babe and cuts him down. He takes him on to Corinth, where the crown, King Polybus, adopts him as his own and teaches him to one day hold the throne.
Unwilling to slay the only sire he knew, Oedipus beats hard, gives up his throne, and vows to hurl himself at any dare who his prospects bleed, he does no longer can.
Wandering without purpose, only urge, he comes upon a place where three roads merge. A traveler and his men ask him to yield. Oedipus responds with sword and shield.
An exchange of arms and suits, leaving dead the traveler and his driver. The others fled, and Oedipus, the road is now his, proceeds to call a fate wherever his road leads.
approaching Thebes, he's greeted by a sphinx, half lion, half a woman, and all jinx. A beast who terrorizes all the land by asking riddles none can understand.
Not so well, because the sphinx will let you live. Yes, it will. Bowering your head, go for a smack, tossing your boat to the top of your boat side of staff.
The beast demands her due, the youth agrees. The sphinx lets slip a smile, like any piece. What creature walks on 4 feet in the morn, on 2 at noon, but you're yet evening born?
Disbelief shining in hotly in her eyes, the vanquished monster leaps to her demise, and Oedipus is hailed by Thebans all as he who caused the horrid beast to fall.
Fate smiles as Oedipus is anointed king. He wears the crown of Laius. Everything his father once commanded, he now rules from courtiers and advisors down to fools.
He takes the queen Jocasta for his bride and rules all Thebes with dignity and pride. For 30 years, the country lives in peace, while commerce and contentment both increase.
Dorothy?
Hello? Hello?
Dorothy?
Until the fates revive, their horrid curse is set to send throughout the land a plague perverse that kills the crops and leaves the rest to starve to death, a country most distressed.
It's one more riddle to confound the king, unspoken and unseen, an unknown thing. If he can solve it, all starvation ends, and with the gods, the wise king makes amends.
At Delphi, you see, the Apollo replies, he would kill Laius and open your eyes. The picture of blindness makes it free. Okay, this mad man.
Nobody responds. The king grows irate. I must learn this truth. It governs our state. He summons Tiresias, wise and revered, who refuses to talk, but this have I feared.
Oedipus learns that to defy his own fate, he killed his father, usurped the whole state, married his mother, and fathered 2 heirs. Thus in defiance, he stepped in fate's snares.
Very good. Let's do one more. This is all very good practice here for tomorrow when you're going to, as your recitation, present your inquiry, your whatever you've come up with in terms of your explanation of the law. Okay. Let's go to Pegasus, 199. And I believe, Donna, you're up.
Hey.
flood, when cursed Medusa died, I could see broken the ocean's tide, aroused by songs on the shore, the winged horse, Pegasus, gives to soar.
Judy?
Hang on. The sky is no limit for this charging seed, who brooks no one to put him on a wing. Serves the muses in what they require, and carries lightning bolts for Thor to fire.
Dorothy? Dorothy? Oh, is she offline? Oh, well, all right, I'll read for Dorothy then. But not all fabulous beasts are of this kind. The chimera is as nasty as you'll find. Part lion and part goat, a dragon's tail. Anyone who fights him is bound to fail.
Raised from hell, chimera breathing fire, lays waste Lycia, arousing widespread ire. The high abeyance calls on Thor for aid, and calls on Pegasus. A deal is made.
Nerva, find a golden bridle to put on.
By soaring high above the fiery beast, Bellerophon aims his arrow, release. The arrow flies with swiftness through the air and kills the dreaded chimera unaware.
Pegasus retires to Pierius Spring, where his days are spent at ease, listening to his friends, the muses, and letting poets ride upon his back to be tutored by their side.
Good. The answer to the mystery here is Bellerophon. Bellerophon. So, good. Well, very good. You're all doing quite well. Like I say, tomorrow we will let you, Thursday, right, not tomorrow, the next day, Thursday, we will let you deliver your own words as you talk about the law. So that's it for today. Thank you, and have a good day tomorrow, and see you on Thursday.
Good night.